Lord, we love you and we honor you. We pray, Lord, that you would give us insight and that our eyes would be open to your truth and your truth alone. In Yeshua's name, amen. In Psalm 119, verse 18, the psalmist prayed, Gal enai, open or uncover my eyes, v'abita niflaot mitaratecha, and I will behold wonders from your teaching, from your law. So there are wonders to behold in the scriptures, right? We know in Luke 24, after his resurrection, that Yeshua sits with his disciples and he opens their minds so they can understand the scriptures, right? So they're amazing truths as we dig. And it is true that if you can study the Bible in the original languages, there are many treasures there that will open up to you. Of course, I would far rather have someone who knew the Lord, loved the Lord, walked in humility, could barely read English, and read from a simple English translation and walked with the Lord than some brilliant scholar that had the Bible memorized in the original languages and didn't know the Lord, right? But there's people always want to dig, and often the things that become most popular, especially on internet these days, are things that are completely false, just myths. So I want to talk about a few of those, but then give you some examples of the beauty of the Hebrew and what really is there and what really does open up if you study it in the original languages. Some years back, there was a lot of talk about Bible codes. And there were Israeli mathematicians, scientists, you know, brilliant people that were shown these secret codes in scripture, and the result, they did statistical analysis, they were convinced this could only be inspired, and they became traditional Jews. I think they still are to this day. And a lot of Christians got excited about this because, wow, this was further proof of the inspiration of scripture. What they didn't know was that the people that popularized the codes and would do seminars around the country also pointed out how these same codes identified Jesus as a false prophet. And this was part of their bringing Jews into tradition and away from Yeshua. The problem is the thing breaks down on many, many levels, as amazing as it seems. One issue is, why is it always pointing to past events? In other words, if you'll start counting every seven letters from this letter and go through all these books, you'll find XYZ amazing things unfolding. One question was, okay, if it talked about the destruction of the Twin Towers, why did you only find that after? You know, where it gives the birth, the time of birth and death of famous rabbis, allegedly. You know, when you go through it, look at what we discovered. The question is, how come it never predict anything in advance? You know, why is it always stuff in the past? Okay, well, you could say it's a supernatural code to prove that the Bible's really inspired. Then if you're a follower of Yeshua, the question is, well, why were these same codes used to mark him as a false prophet? And some other scholars did analysis, took a thick book like Moby Dick in English, and did similar kind of counts and found all kinds of amazing things there. No one would argue for the inspiration of Moby Dick, but the, I mean, it's a powerful story, right? But okay, these days you never know. You never know. Oh, don't you know, Dr. Brown, there's a Moby Dick cult? No, I didn't know. I didn't know anything about that. You know, after 46 years of marriage, even when you're not with your spouse, you hear your spouse's voice in your head. So I was about to go on a tangent, and I heard that voice saying, you don't want to do that, so I'm not going to do that. It was about QAnon, actually, but that somebody here might believe in that and send me a nasty letter afterwards. So the biggest problem with this whole Bible code thing, which is equidistant letter sequence, so you count X number of letters, it's all based on a certain text of the Bible, right? And if you're an ultra-Orthodox Jew, you believe that that text has been preserved exactly the same from our day back to Moses. The problem is that we know for a fact that spelling conventions change over centuries. For example, how many of you remember spelling judgment with an E after the G? You remember that? You know, if you live in England or some other English-speaking countries, you still spell color, O-U-R, favor, O-U-R. We drop those. I remember when you would write worshiping, it was two P's. And then spell checker started to correct that. I thought that's worshiping. It's a single P, it's worshiping. It's worshiping with two P's, but it's changed. Well, we know from ancient inscriptions, we know from ancient writings and then ancient manuscripts that the Hebrew language, the spelling changed. So the way Moses would have spelled things would have been a little different than the way Isaiah spelled them, and certainly different than the way it was ultimately passed down today. So once you realize that the spelling changes, that changes the letter sequence. Just there, the whole thing breaks down. So all it would mean is a particular text used at a particular time has these very interesting phenomena, but they can also be explained in other ways. But that's just, I'm not getting into that in a major way, but that's just one example. And I bring it up because it's not what the Bible's about. The Bible's not about a secret code. I was telling the students teaching over at Mercy Culture, I'm in your area once a month, teaching 3 days at CFNI and 2 days at Mercy Culture School, and then doing my radio show in the afternoon. And I was telling the first year students at Mercy Culture that when I was a new believer, I was brand new. Right, came out of heavy drug use. It used to be known as Drug Bear and Iron Man because of my heavy drug use. Now I'm radically saved. So people think, oh, well, you're Jewish. You understand the Bible. Well, how does shooting heroin help me understand the Bible? How does going to Jimi Hendrix or Led Zeppelin in concert help me understand the Bible? The little Hebrew that I knew enough to be bar mitzvahed and just read it without even understanding what I was reading, I'd forgotten most of that. Now, I could help. Some of the passages in the book of Revelation, I had seen that stuff while high on drugs. I had seen some of those bits like, oh, the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns. I can tell you what that looks like. But seriously, I had no background at all. So I'm reading the Bible. The translation we have is the King James Bible. So I'm reading it. And one day I'm just starting at the beginning in Genesis. And I notice words italicized. So italicized normally means emphasis, right? Unless it's a proper title, like the title of a book or something. You see something italicized, it means you're emphasizing it. He was really fast. Okay, really is italicized. So I'm reading this, and I'm reading the italics as if they're emphasis. But it's not working. It just, when you read Genesis 1, if you have a King James physically, you may not find it in an online, but you'll see words like is, was, land, and it's like emphasis is not working here. I thought it's something else. I thought, I figured it out. It's a code. You get this. Remember, I'm brand new, and nobody spotted it until now. These translators were so brilliant. They had this code here. So what I should do is just read the italicized words. So that was tremendously revelatory. Is, was, land, and. So I didn't know what it was. And of course, it's just the King James custom. If it wasn't explicitly there in Hebrew or Greek, you put it in italics. In any case. And for those that are wondering, I said the spelling changed, not the words changed, not the meaning changed, but spelling conventions change. So the whole problem with the secret code idea is that God's communicating plainly to us in what's written. It would be as if I'm speaking to you, but you have to now get the message and now listen to it and computer analyze it and count every 3 letters and skip the fourth. I'm communicating now. Fire! Everybody get out of the building! What do you think he means by that? I noticed that if you count, you skip letters. No, you run out of the building. So God's word communicates clearly. The prophets weren't stoned for secret codes, right? Paul didn't write a letter to the Corinthians and expect them to decode it. No, it's just do what it says. Another thing that you find in traditional Judaism that sometimes makes its way over into the Christian world, not so much as gematria. And you might even argue that there's a biblical base for it. So gematria says that we know that at a certain point in time, the Hebrew letters became used as numbers, right? So we have letters is one thing, numbers is another. But if you know Hebrew, the first letter is Aleph, right? And Aleph is also one. So Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet is 1, 2, 3, 4. And then you get up to Kof, that stands for 100, Resh, 200, etc., until you get to Tav, 400. And then you just put them together, and that's how you make numbers. So people began to say, well, wait, well, then if these are all letters and the letters can have numerical value, maybe we should look at the numerical value of a word, right? And now see what other words have that same numerical value. So you can come up with all kinds of fascinating insights, and you can also create whatever you want to create. In other words, everything can mean anything. That you can literally find whatever in the world you want. So we know that in the genealogy in Matthew, Matthew divides things up into three groups of 14 in the genealogy of Yeshua there. And scholars have pointed out, well, David's name, David, Dalet Vav Dalet, is 4, 6, 4. That equals 14. Is that why he chose to divide it into 14? Could be. Could be. You know, you have in Revelation 13 that, you know, the number of the Antichrist, you know, 666. And would that have then referred to Nero Caesar and so on, you know, and debates about that. So you do have examples where this may be used. But when people really get into it, it's a game. You can literally make anything mean anything. You don't find that so much in Christian circles, but there's something that has really become very popular now. So popular that when I debunked it in a video, I had people calling me a false prophet, not saved, hellbound, servant of Satan, for debunking this myth. So this is one you've probably heard of more. This is the last example I'm going to give of the negative, and then just give you some neat examples from the Hebrew. And those that are just listening to Pastor Robert preach will have to eat their hearts out. Okay, so it is true that the Hebrew language originally, the Hebrew letters, which are most likely borrowed from Phoenician, originally came from pictures. That's true. And originally you had communication. As people began to write, they used pictographs. They used pictures of things. So if you're going to communicate through pictures, let's say someone walking or kicking, maybe you use a foot. Well, what about kneeling? Okay, you got to draw that. Okay, what about how are you going to get sentences out? It's going to require a lot of pictures. So if you look at the ancient hieroglyphics, there are a lot of different pictures. The earliest writings, pictographs, you had several thousand. The Chinese letters, you know, in their earliest form, thousands, because it takes a lot of different pictures to communicate things. So over a period of time, the pictures were reduced to sounds, and then ultimately you got the alphabet. So what the alphabet did was say, okay, let's just say that you had the word book, right? And let's just say it was a picture. Someone drew a picture of what looked like a book, right? So now the alphabet, you're going to use that same picture, but it's just going to stand for B. That's all it means. It doesn't mean book anymore. It just means B. So the genius of the alphabet was to take the pictographs, to take the first letter of a particular picture, make that into now the letter itself, and now you could build all kinds of words. You didn't need thousands and thousands of pictures. You just needed, in the case of Hebrew, 22 letters. And Hebrew, like English, uses same letters for different sounds. You're used to it because it's English. You don't notice. But how do you know that the word garage is not drag? How do you know it's garage? It's the same G, isn't it? But first G is a hard G, and the second is a soft. How about circus, right? How do you know that first C is a ka, or excuse me, is a sa, and the second C is a ka? See, they didn't know it was going to get this deep, huh? Okay. All right, so I'm just showing you that in English, you use the same letters, and they're used differently. You're not even conscious of it because you're just used to it. If you learn it as a foreigner, it's like, wow, this is a confusing language. It really is. Or right? Thank you, that's one sound. This is a different sound, th versus the. Same letters. You just know it because you learn it like that. So the same way in Hebrew, there are originally different letters that had several different pronunciations, and then it just kind of coalesces. But real simple, again, let's say you want to talk about a watch? Of course, you wouldn't have a watch in the ancient world, but let's just say you did. So you draw a picture of a watch. Now you want to make an alphabet where you have the letter W. So you use the picture of a watch, but it doesn't stand for a watch anymore. It just stands for W, right? So in the Hebrew language, what's the first letter? Aleph. So what did Aleph originally look like? It was an ox head, okay? So let's just picture this. Let's picture this. It's like an upside down V, okay? And now just horns there. So you got this and horns. That was the ox head. So where did the Greek alphabet come from? Anybody know? Hebrew, actually Phoenician, the same origins. So Hebrew alphabet associated comes from Phoenician. Greek comes from Phoenician. So what's the first letter of the Greek alphabet? Alpha. So Aleph in Hebrew, Alpha, right? And that basically looks like an A. So then that comes through Latin into English. So our English capital A, that originally goes back to ox head. Just look at the A and pull the sides out a little bit, and there's your ox head. Okay? The same for B, the second letter. So the Hebrew, that's Aleph, Beit. So Beit is from Bayit, which means house. What's second letter of the Greek alphabet? Beta. So Aleph, Beit, Alpha, Beta. English, A, B. So you look at a capital B, right? That's similar to what the ancient pictograph looked like, because it was a house. It was like an enclosure. So you just modify that a little bit. So even our English letters ultimately go back to Phoenician Hebrew, which ultimately go back to pictures, all right? But once it becomes an alphabet, it's no longer a picture. And that's why you can turn it on its side. You can, so, you know, if you write in Hebrew script, an aleph is looks like a C and then a line next to it. It's totally different. It's changed. And as you'll see, as the alphabet's written differently over the centuries, the aleph that's written that we picked up from Aramaic in the Babylonian captivity, that's written completely differently. So if I show you a Hebrew Bible, that aleph looks nothing like an ox or an ox head, right? Why? Because it doesn't need to anymore, because it doesn't stand for that. It just stands for aleph, and Beit just stands for Beit, etc. So there is an older form of Hebrew writing called Paleo-Hebrew. It's not a language. Not a language at all. It is a form of writing. So we have in English cursive writing where you write in script like that, and then just regular writing. So this is an older form of writing. It's not a dialect. Paleo-Hebrew is not a dialect. It's not a language. It is an older form of how you write the alphabet. And the older form looks more like pictures, okay? Because that's where it started. And then it changed over the centuries. So it has become very, very popular today to say that a great way to get further insight into the meaning of the Hebrew is to go back to the pictographic meaning. So Aleph actually has to do with ox head or an ox, which stands for power. This is a complete myth, okay? This stands for power or and then look at God's name, Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton, Yahweh. If you look at it, it's a message about the crucifixion. And it's nonsense. It's complete myth. It's people reading into it whatever they want to read into it. When you start taking 22 letters, now 22 pictures, and you're going to communicate everything through 22 pictures, it can mean absolutely anything. You know, it reminds me, when I was a boy, my dad told me a story of a guy who was a sex offender in prison. And the prison psychologist met with him, and he drew a circle, and he said to the man, "What do you see?" And the guy gave him some pornographic answer, and the psychologist was shocked. So then he drew a square. He said, "What do you see?" He gave him another obscene answer, and the guy's shocked. He said, "Just a straight line. What do you see?" He gives him an obscene answer. And he says, "Sir, I can tell you have a filthy mind." He goes, "What do you mean? You're the one showing me the filthy pictures." So, I mean, people are reading everything. And, oh, Genesis 1, the opening verse, it means the opening word, it means this. It's like, no, it means whatever you make it to mean. So once you have an alphabet, it's no longer pictographs. Doesn't matter what they are. Just like in English. Oh, A, Abraham Lincoln, A, ox head, authority. See, that's it. He was the president. It's confirmed. It's like, it's that crazy. And when you just puncture that balloon of myth, people flip out. And my simple thing is, isn't the word of God enough? Isn't the plain sense of what God says enough to keep us on our face in obedience and to keep us studying the rest of our lives, to keep us learning and searching? So some of the things that really are there in Hebrew, you don't have poetry in Hebrew the way you have in English, with rhymes and things like that. It's more a matter of meter and flow. So you have meter in English as well. You have it in Hebrew, but you don't have rhymes as much. But you often have, like Isaiah in particular, uses alliteration a lot. So this is something you wouldn't know unless you were reading it in Hebrew. You know, it starts off in the first chapter, Shimu Shamayim. So that's, if I was saying it in English, hear heaven, Hazinu Aretz. Some alliteration there. Later in the chapter, he's rebuking them for their princes are all rebels. Sarayach Sororim. Just, you know, a little alliteration like that. So if you translate in English, if you translate it accurately, you lose the alliteration. He's just move it a little. Your rulers are rebels instead of princes. You know, that carries it. In Isaiah, the fifth chapter, and translators wrestle with this endlessly to try to come up with a clever way to do it. And as I'm doing a commentary on Isaiah and translating it, I can't tell you how much time I've messed with it in my mind and still haven't come up with something. But God says in Isaiah 5, I looked for mishpat, justice, but instead there was mispach, which is like violence. And then I looked for tzedakah, which is righteousness, and instead tzaka, a cry. So you translate it accurately, but then you lose the alliteration. You lose the little rhyming and word plays. So that's where you're like, what's the best way to do it? But it's a beautiful thing. I mean, that's there in the Hebrew. That's not disputed. And that's the author's intent. Or in the seventh chapter, King Ahaz is being rebuked. Im lo taminu ki lo te'amenu. And it's literally, if you don't believe, it's because you're not firmly established. So how do you convey that? You know, sometimes people find a good way to convey the wordplay there. You have something in, and of course, you know, the Greek has wordplays as well. You have something called chiasmus, which is based on the Greek letter chi, which is like an X, right? So everybody's still with me. Eyes are glazing. Some of you are thinking, this must be significant because it's Dr. Brown, but I just don't get it. that's okay. It's just, I want to do something juicy for Abdallah. Okay. So chiasmus is a type of parallelism. Let's divide a sentence into three parts, A, B, C, right? So think of the A as the top of one X, and then the B, A, B, C. And then when I say the second part of the sentence, it's going to be the reverse. It's going to be C, B, A. So what comes first here comes last there. And what comes last comes first. And the middle is the middle. So it'll make sense in a moment. Although this also reminds me of a time when I was teaching Korean Christians about 40 years ago in New York City. They were all in ministry and active church jobs and other jobs, but we're taking one day a week to take Hebrew or take other subject. So I was teaching Hebrew, and these folks are working hard, pushing heavy schedule, and we're going, you know, their English is not as perfect, so I'm speaking in English and teaching biblical Hebrew, and now they're getting used to the new forms and the letters and all this. And I asked them at one point, I said, any questions? And one of them said, Reverend Brown, everything a question. Okay, so does anyone happen here to know off the top of your head Proverbs chapter 10, verse 12? You probably know it, you just don't know where it is. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers a multitude of sins. So that's chiastic parallelism in Hebrew, which is really opens it up. So sina, that's A, that comes first. Hatred, te'orer, that's B, that's second part. stirs up midanim, strife. Sinah te'orer midanim. Hatred stirs up strife. A, B, C. Va'al chol pesha'im, that's C. But over all transgressions, techaseh be, that's B. Ahava, love. So literally, hatred stirs up strife, but over all transgressions covers love. And of course, the verbal sequence is changed so that it starts with the word sinah, hatred, and ends with the word love. And you have the difference in the results. So that's just a type of parallelism that's there, that when you read it, it's not just beautiful, but it drives things home, the contrast. Sinah te'orer midanim. Hatred stirs up strife. Va'al kol pesha'im techaseh ahava. But over all transgressions covers love. So you have examples like that. You have something else called Janus parallelism. This is based on a Greek god that had two faces, Janus. And this is one that's a more recent discovery that scholars began to notice this. But I'll give an example from Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 12. So the NIV says, flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come. The cooing of doves is heard in our land. So the first part of the verse is talking about flowers. Flowers are appearing, right? The second half of the verse is talking about singing. The cooing of doves is heard in our land, because it is the season of singing. But what's it got to do with flowers? Well, the word singing in Hebrew is zamir. But zamir can also mean pruning. So scholars have suggested that there are times in the Hebrew where a word is used with a double meaning in the middle of a verse. And the first half of the verse means it one way, and the second half means it the other way. So flowers appear on the earth. The season of pruning slash singing has come. The cooing of doves is heard in our land. One scholar claims to have found 50 examples of this in the book of Job. Now, I did a commentary on Job and wrote a translation of Job, and I think that's a high number. But it's one of these things that this really could be here. And it's brilliant, in other words, to have that double meaning intentionally there is brilliant. All I'm saying is, even if you're not getting any of this, is that there's a lot of fascinating stuff that's really there. You don't have to create myths and come up with all these other things. There's a lot of fascinating stuff that's really there. Or just, I mentioned parallelism in Hebrew. So it's only by syllables and emphasis. And, you know, we're used to it. Remember learning as a kid, Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, Samuel Taylor Coleridge. So it had a certain rhythm. It's like 8 to 7 syllables, things like that. So you have these rhythms in Hebrew. You have them through the Psalms. You have them through poetry. It's very, very common. There's something called kinah, which is lamentation. And that has three emphases in the first half of the verse and two in the second. And it's kind of like dragging a leg. It's a feeling of lament. So that feeling of lament is built in to the psalm. Or just little things like ending a verse with the same word for emphasis, different than the chiastic parallelism. So Isaiah 53:6. In Hebrew, kulanu katzon ta'inu, ish l'darko panim v'aranayef hifgibo et avon kulanu. So all of us, kulanu, like sheep, have gone astray. Each has turned to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the sin of kulanu, all of us. So it's a beautiful emphasis. It starts with all of us. We've all gone astray. The Lord has laid on Yeshua the sin of all of us. So, I mean, these are just things that are there that you read. It's like, wow, that's beautiful. That's neat. That lays it out clearly. Or just one other example of knowing Hebrew, how there's some treasures to find. Take a look with me in Matthew chapter 2. And when I pause shortly and go to questions, feel free to to ask me about anything that I talked about, and your question can be as basic as, in other words, don't think you're asking a dumb question, because probably others have the same questions. Or it can be something we haven't talked about at all, that you just heard it and want to find out, is it true or not? So Matthew chapter 2. Now, I could imagine this after the service, if you're not going to be there tomorrow to hear the message, say, what did Pastor Robert speak on? And they'll tell you this. What did Dr. Brown speak on? Better to just get the tape. All right, so Yeshua with his family as a boy, Joseph, right, verse 23, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So it was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. So which prophet said that? What chapter and verse? Well, there is no verse that says he'll be called a Nazarene anywhere in the Bible. So did Matthew make it up? Did he spend decades working on his gospel and finally put it in written form, only to have any educated Jew shoot it down within seconds? Did he think he just tricked the ignorant? Nobody would notice that he made it up? The way some critics attack it, you'd think so. But notice he doesn't use his normal formula of saying what was said through the prophet or through Isaiah or through. He doesn't say that. What was said through the prophets, plural. So what's he talking about? Well, on the one hand, Nazareth is like nowheresville. So the Messiah coming from Nazareth would be a very obscure idea. So the Messiah coming from obscurity, the prophets did talk about that. You know, Isaiah 53 and lowly origins and things like that. But what's interesting is that one of the messianic titles of the Messiah is Tzemach, branch, which you find, for example, in Jeremiah 23, and then in Zechariah 3 and Zechariah 6. Messianic title, Tzemach, most clearly in Jeremiah 23 and in Zechariah 6. There's also a parallel word, which is Netzer. So it's like a shoot or branch coming up. And where's that found? That's found in Isaiah 11:1, that a Netzer will come from the root of Jesse. So what Matthew's doing is saying, dig here. It's very common for the rabbis to use plays on words. They did it all the time. It's in the Hebrew Bible, right? The city of Babylon. What does that come from? That God balaled the tongues, confused the tongues. But that's not actually what it comes from. It's Babylonian, Babi Elu, the gate of the gods. But Hebrews, it's giving a play on words. It would be like saying they call him Mike because he always talks through the mic. Everybody knows it's a play on words, okay? The same with the Pharaoh's daughter pulling Moses out of the, you know, taking Moses out of the water to raise him. Moses most likely comes from Egyptian, meaning son. But in Hebrew there, in the second chapter, that she says that she drew him out of the water, and it's attributed to as if it was Hebrew. Now, it's possible she was Semitic and spoke Hebrew. It's most likely this is meant to be a play on word. You have it commonly in the Hebrew Bible. You know, with Jacob, right? Getting called deceiver by his brother. Well, the parents did not name him. Let's name him Deceiver. That's a good name, Deceiver. Or Naval. That's fool. It have another meaning, but fool. What should we name him? It's our firstborn, honey. Let's call him Fool. No, but when he acts foolishly later, they say, you're acting like your name, Fool. Just like saying, hey, now we know why they call you Mike, because you speak through the mic all the time. These plays on words are, everybody knows they're plays on words. They call him Frank because he's very frank. Honey, what should we call our baby? Let's call him Frank because I think he's going to be Frank one day. No, that's not why you do it. So the point is, Matthew, in this environment where plays on words are very common, is saying this was spoken by the prophets. Well, several of them call them the branch, and Isaiah refers to him specifically as the Netzer, which sounds like Nazareth, Netzareth, and then he comes from all the origins. So he's putting this all together, basically saying, dig, there's some treasures to find if you dig. So these things are real. And there's so much stuff like this that when you dig to what's really there, you discover all kinds of fascinating things. And then many of them just enhance your appreciation for the word, or like Proverbs 10:12, you know, convey the truth more powerfully, or things like that. And then even just studying what's there, clear as day in front of you, that's a lifetime worth. You know, after 51, almost 51 years in the Lord now, people may think, you know, I know a lot or this. I'm always amazed at how much there is to learn and how little I know at this stage, how much there is to discover, just into what's actually here. And why did this one quote this? And why is this written like this without even knowing any Hebrew or Greek? Just study it in the languages that you can read. And then when you dig back, it's even more. There's no need for the fantasy stuff. The only thing the fantasy stuff gives you is an outlet to find whatever you want, to make anything mean whatever you want. And that's not why the Bible is here, A. And B, that's not what God is communicating through it. He's not going to ask us one day, but did you check the code? You thought you were following me, but the code actually is secret code. No, it's not that. You ever done one of these things with your family, these escape rooms, and there are these codes and things? So we've done it with our family. I'm like helpless with this. I'm just looking at this. Okay, it says what it means, and I'm not getting it. Then no, this code probably means this. And, you know, our granddaughter, she's like, how'd you figure that out? It's like a different, God's not requiring that with the Bible. He's not requiring that. And sometimes, here, I'll close with this story. Sometimes God just wants us to say, okay, it says this, and I'm just supposed to do it. I'm just supposed to obey it. And the looking for mysteries distracts us. So years ago, a fellow I'd led to the Lord in high school, he's getting married, and our church that particular year put up a little tent, and we're holding tent meetings on our property. We'd never done that before. And the young man asked the pastor, my wife and I would love to get married outside in the tent. Could you keep it up, you know, after the meetings are over? He said, well, it's a time of the year we're going to get some storms. It's really not the best to have the tent up. But he really asked him, and he said, okay, we'll leave it up. So we go over to a church building, Methodist church building, if I remember, and we meet the sexton, the guy responsible for maintaining the building. And this is the backup plan. If there's rain or anything like that, this is the backup plan, that he'll have the building ready when we go over there. But the groom, he's full of faith. He says, no, I've prayed, and I know God's answering my prayer, and it's going to be fine. We're not going to have rain. Tent's going to be fine. So we're not going to need the building, but thank you. Anyway, okay. So the day comes, and it is miserable pouring rain with biting winds that literally rip through the tent. So I show up there. I'm in the wedding party. I show up there in my tux. They're all there, and they're going around. They have T-shirts and towels trying to wipe off the chairs as the rain is pouring in. It's like, buddy, it's not going to happen. So he calls the church. This sexton, I don't think the sexton was even a believer. Just his job works in the place. He calls the guy up, and he says, is there any way that we could use the church? He goes, I cleaned the floor yesterday. I knew you were coming. I looked at the weather report. So a lot of times God just wants to just do what it says, just nothing mystical, nothing magical. Just, oh, you actually want, yes, be nice to your spouse. Oh, but I've seen the pictograph that, no, be nice to your spouse. Sometimes just doing those things. All right, so with that, an unforgettable Havdalah teaching. If you have a question of any kind, especially that ties in with anything that I've talked about, yes.
And some letters in the middle are emphasized and drawn bigger by the scribes.
Yes, yeah, so you have, yeah, so I'm going to repeat it. So the question is, why are there some examples of the Hebrew Bible in the text that we widely use in synagogues and things, where you'll have a particular letter written big. Why is that? Or a letter written differently. In some cases, we don't know. There's debate over it. For example, in Isaiah the 9th chapter, the famous prophecy, Ki yelad yulad lanu benditanu, for a child's born to us, son given to us, that is ultimately a messianic prophecy, but in context you would have initially thought it was about Hezekiah. There is the letter M, when it's at the end of the word, is written differently than when it's in the beginning or middle. So there's a final mem, the one you stick at the end, but it's in the middle of a word. So why is it there? And the rabbis say, well, because God was going to make Hezekiah the Messiah, but when he failed, they changed it, so they closed the mem. It's all speculative. We don't know. Sometimes you have a letter written upside down or dots over it. There's debate. There's different theories, but this is all much later. In other words, this is something the scribes did. Or for example, in Genesis 32, where Jacob and Esau meet, and the text says that he kissed him, right? But there are dots over it. Why are there dots? Well, speculation, he didn't kiss him. He bit his neck. And then, you know, one famous, you know, rabbinic scholar in the 1200s said it's just childish to think stuff like that. But it's just, so it's debate. We don't know. But that's something later that the scribes did for some reason. And we're not exactly sure. So that's something there that later scribes did, but there's debate as to why they did it. Yeah. Another question, and I'll try to repeat it so everyone can hear. Any questions? You probably had 100 questions before your minds went dull partway through my little lecture here. Okay, question. Yes, sir.
So what do the rabbis say in Daniel, like 7:13, it says that he saw thrones in heaven. What do the rabbis say about that?
Not one throne, but thrones.
Right, so there, we would emphasize the deity of Messiah as found there. And some do believe that it's pointing to Messiah as being depicted there. But the idea of multiple thrones, there was some early Jewish teaching, you have, you know, maybe in the second century, that had a debate about that in terms of multiple powers in heaven, that there's not just one power, but multiple powers, and that's part of what was fed into the Messianic movement, belief in Yeshua as divine. But the idea of God establishing thrones for others wouldn't be that problematic, or, you know, giving Israel authority, as long as God is the ultimate authority that gives it. So, but it does become a discussion. If you look at Alan Siegel's book about two powers in heaven, he gets into that, because some did emphasize that, well, why are there two thrones? Doesn't that indicate another power, you know, alongside with God's power? But just looked at otherwise, if God sets up whatever thrones there are and he has dominion, it wouldn't be a problem.
Isaiah 53. Like, what is the...
Well, wait, hang on. Hang on. I didn't give everybody else another chance yet. Plus, if I'm correct, we have a car ride after this. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
He makes things a little bit simple, but I just curious, Dr. Brown, when I go to the Jewish meeting, they always say the Shema, Israel, prayer.
Yes.
Is that a group? What's the meaning behind that?
Right, so this is, the question is, in a traditional Jewish service, and in many Messianic services, you'll hear the Shema prayed. So Shema is Hebrew for hear, right? Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Or it could also be translated, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. So it has become, even though throughout Deuteronomy, there are many times where Moses or God will say, Shema, listen. This becomes one of the most sacred prayers in Judaism, recited at least twice daily and recited in synagogue gatherings. A religious Jew will cover his eyes when saying it to give ultimate concentration and focus. And for a Jewish person, it is a confession of the oneness of God. And therefore, for a Jewish person to believe what we believe in God's triunity, so that his unity is complex, that would be considered a fundamental violation, as it's taught many years later by Moses Maimonides, it becomes this exclusive singularity in God. But it is a Jew confessing his loyalty to God and God alone, and also confessing that God is one. And so there were Jews who would be offered baptism or death during some of the worst times of the Crusades, and they would die with the Shema on their lips, making that profession that they're loyal to God. And of course, what they were being presented with was foreign as well. You know, that had nothing to do with the gospel. So it's a sacred prayer. It's Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. And then you read through the following verses. What follows it, so there's the Shema, and then a rabbinic line that was added, about, you know, blessing the Lord's kingdom. And then you read on the rest of the verses about loving God with heart, soul, and speaking them to your children, etc. So this is very central to traditional Judaism. And it's very important for us to explain the oneness of God in a way that they can comprehend. Other questions? Yes, sir. Right. So based on recent archaeological evidence, it's really not recent evidence, but a new interpretation that's being put on it. Some inscriptions that would have been ancient Sinaitic inscriptions from hundreds of years earlier than Phoenician script. One scholar in particular has really advanced this idea that the Hebrew alphabet does go back to the people of Israel, not the Phoenicians, and that you have some very, very early forms of it in this writing that basically nobody's been able to decipher. Writings on stone, very limited, that no one's been able to decipher. So from what I can tell, the vast majority of Semitic scholars don't accept that, don't agree with it, and find it to be speculative. I haven't been able to devote time to look at it, nor have I kept up with things where I think that my opinion is better than some of these fellows. So it's possible. I mean, it's totally fine with me. It doesn't matter where it originated. We certainly know where it distributes from, which is from the Phoenician script. You know, once things happen at a certain point in time and distribution comes, we know where the Greeks found it, and that was, you know, in Phoenician use. So it's possible, but certainly just one very minority scholarly opinion right now. Yes, sir. Right, so why is it that 6,300 times roughly in the Hebrew Bible, you have Lord, capital L, small caps ORD in our English translations, and not Yahweh, or as previously mispronounced, Jehovah. The simple thing is that over a period of time, it was considered too sacred to pronounce. Now, exactly when in history is debatable. You have in the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, that sometimes when they're writing that word, they write it with a different pen, or they're writing in the Hebrew form of the day, and then they write that in the old Hebrew form. That was signifying already sacredness. Was it pronounced or not? Debatable. You have some manuscripts of Septuagint where it seems to be written in, but basically from what we can tell, when you get to the New Testament period, that when New Testament writers are quoting, they're writing in Greek, they say Kyrios, Lord. They don't use the divine name, which would indicate that it could well even be that by that time it was considered too sacred to pronounce. So we know for sure at a certain point in history, in ancient history, the name was considered too sacred to pronounce. So rather than say Yahweh or however it was originally pronounced, you would say Lord instead. And the way you distinguish it if you're reading in English is it's capital L and then small caps, O-R-D. As opposed to capital L, small O-R-D. That's how you know it's originally Yahweh. The Syriac, the Peshitta, seems to make a distinction, but that's subsequent to the Greek. Now, if you're a traditional Jew, even if you're spelling the name, you won't say the letters. And if you're writing it today, it's not just for the divine name, but anything about God, you'll say G-D, L-R-D. So that's just out of reverence for the name. So the tradition continued to develop. That being said, certainly was not the way it was originally. In other words, when God gave the name to Moses, it was understandable, and he was to speak it and convey it, and there was a play on words in his name. So for us to use the name, as long as we're reverent towards God, is perfectly fine. Yes. No theory. No theory. So, before the time of the flood, what language was used? So you could make a case that Hebrew is used because you have plays on words in Genesis 2, right? Adam is from the Adama, the earth. And Eve is the mother of all living, Chava, which ties in with an earlier root for life. But then again, that could just be writing it in Hebrew. You're writing it with equivalent plays on words. So if it was a Semitic language, you have this original Semitic, which we don't actually have, but it's reconstructed. So could that have been the case? I mean, we don't know. We really don't know. But to say that it was Hebrew would be illogical, just because Hebrew is a developed language itself. Do you know what Isaiah 19 calls Hebrew? Sifat Kanaan, the language of Canaan. Hebrew was a Canaanite dialect. The reason that Abraham and his descendants took it up was because that was one of the languages, main languages that was spoken there. Yeah, so it's a Semitic language, and it's actually a dialect of that was spoken in Canaan, and that's why it's referred to as such. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of languages and translations, transliterations, sometimes there's been a controversy about Passion translation.
Uh-huh.
I personally don't prefer paraphrases, but I'm just curious as to your take.
Yeah, so I'll just try to be brief about this because I've interacted with Brian Simmons, who did the translation. So it's a paraphrase, not a translation. That's the bottom line. And some of it's brilliant and beautiful, but a paraphrase is have you ever used the Message Bible? Right. So the one thing you don't ever want to do is carry that around as the Bible that you read. It's secondary. It is Eugene Peterson drinking in the word and then giving it back in his own words. Okay. It's not meant to be the main Bible you use. Eugene Peterson would be mortified if people did that. Unfortunately, the Passion called translation has been put forward as a primary Bible to use. And there are leaders who do it. It's a big mistake, giant mistake. So there are two camps. There's the camp that says the whole thing is terrible, get rid of it. Brian claims heavenly revelation, and it's like the Book of Mormon, and don't touch it. And there's others that says there's nothing ever like it, and you should use it as a primary translation. So both extremes are wrong. I know Brian, he's sincere. He loves, I mean, we're not close friends, but he really loves the word, and he loves the Lord and wants to convey things in a powerful way. And as I said, there are parts that really beautiful and well done, but there are other things that are just unjustified, additions and things that are just unjustified. So I've urged him, it's not complete. So he's going through it carefully with the goal of putting out a full new edition, a final edition in 2027. And I've encouraged him to listen to all the critiques from scholars, to take that in. And some of it is very paraphrastic, very much a paraphrase, like Song of Solomon, very much. Or some of the verses in Psalms, very much a paraphrase. And it may be beautiful, but it's not what the text says. There are other places that are really close to the text. So it's like two different styles. So I've encouraged him to really kind of land on how he wants to do it. So use it as you find something edifying that's in harmony with Scripture, but wow, I really like the way it says that. Great. But absolutely don't use it as a primary translation, to the point that if you're at a service and the person next to you, that's their Bible, nudge them. Say, is that your primary Bible? Oh, okay. Just check. Say, I authorized it. The Living Bible was the paraphrase that became popular, you know, back in the day when I was younger. And if I'm correct, in 2 Corinthians 10, when Paul's talking about his opposition, and they say, you know, his letters are weighty, but in his bodily presence is weak, and his, you know, speech is nothing. I think the Living Bible says you never heard a worse preacher. So that's good. That's nice. It conveys it. But it's, you know, again, it's just. All right. Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with the alternative temple location, which is south of the Temple Mount.
Yeah.
And how many Christians would you say are aware of that and believe that theory? And how many Jews who are not believers are aware of that? And
as far as Christians, the number is 38,300,000. 20. That's 21. Just went up to 21. Now I haven't the slightest clue. Right? No, I know. I haven't the slightest clue. I would imagine less than a couple of percent. As far as traditional Jews, almost, you know, yeah, very, very little. I'm not an archaeologist. That's not my background or specialization. And I know there are some serious teachers and even scholars that hold to a different location. I'm very skeptical about it. About the other location being legit, and I feel confident that there would have been much more movement to trying to build a third temple if it had been buildable at this point. So I haven't researched it adequately to categorically deny, but I have a big question mark about it. Yes, sir. Okay, first thing, it's wonderful that you want to study the Bible as a 9-year-old. Secondly, Jesus has a special promise for you. Do you know that? Okay, which promise? You think it's probably a lot. Oh, I'm going to give you one because you may be thinking of one. I got another one, okay? So in Matthew, the 11th chapter, Jesus says that his Father has hidden these things, like these wonderful truths about him from the really smart people that think that I know so much, and reveal them to children. So you say, God, you're supposed to reveal stuff to me. So what you do is, on the one hand, just read a little bit of the Bible every day so you can, like, get the whole story, the whole picture. And then ask God, just open, give me insight. Lord, show me. What is it? How should I live this out? Look at it that it's like your dad telling you, okay, hey, I want you to clean your room today, make your bed, then we're going to go out and play ball, right? So he's giving you instructions. So, Lord, what are your instructions for me today, all right? And then it'll be clear. You'll see. He's got a lot of good stuff for you. Sweet. And you'd be way ahead of me starting at 9. Yes, ma'am.
Recently, I heard Tim Mackey, a project teacher for the Divine Council,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered what he was
about. All right, so the question about, quote, the Divine Council. So my colleague Michael Heiser has really popularized a lot of this. And when he was on my show the first time, we talked about it because we have similar backgrounds. His master's was in, like, ancient Eastern history, and then his PhD languages. My master's and PhD were languages, but, you know, very similar. We both studied in secular institutions and, you know, Jewish scholars that we studied with. So In Canaanite religion, you had this El, the chief god, El meaning God, the chief god, and then this divine council of other deities. So it was polytheistic. So the question is, if you look at Psalm 82, God sits in the council of the gods. Is that Canaanite religion, but now being brought over here so that these are angelic beings that God has appointed over the nations, right? Or is that just that language being used about God and his leaders, his, you know, earthly leaders and rulers? So if it's very clear in Scripture that there are other beings called gods, right? You know, in Exodus 12, God's going to judge the gods of Egypt. Or the famous words in Exodus 15, Micha Mocha Ba'alim Adonai, who is like you among the gods, O Lord? So we know there were beings that people worshipped. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, they're actually demons, right? For sure, there were angelic beings that were fallen angelic beings like Satan that would have been worshipped by the peoples in the ancient world that had certain power, but they were all created. They were not really gods, which is why those so-called gods are not gods at all, but there are other beings. So if there is, quote, divine counsel, it would be the angels that God has appointed over the nations, or certainly just the other spiritual beings that he rules over, some in rebellion, some not. But what we were talking about was like, this was just common knowledge in our world of scholarship. The question is, how does it play out in scripture? So people thought Dr. Heiser believes in different gods. No, there's one God. There's only one that's worthy of being called God. Everything else is created, and everything else will be judged by that one God. But it's clear that there are other spiritual powers out there competing for people's worship and attention. It's one reason that God did not give a full revelation of Satan until towards the end of the Old Testament. The earlier on there would have been a full revelation of Satan, the more likely the people would have been to worship him. So what happens in Numbers 21? The people sin, God sends out poisonous snakes among them, right? And then God tells Moses, put up a bronze snake, and when the people look to it, they'll be healed. So what happened to the bronze snake? It shows up in 2 Kings 18, and the people worshipped it. It was called Nechoshet, which is play on words of both bronze and snake. That's what it was called. It had a name, Nechushtan, excuse me. It had a name, and people worshipped it. That was just a snake. So you think what would have happened if there was a full revelation of Satan? So in 2 Samuel 24:1, it says, the anger of the Lord stirred up David to number Israel, right? The parallel to that is 1 Chronicles 21:1, which says, and Satan stirred up David to number Israel. So Chronicles is written hundreds of years after Samuel. It's written after the return from exile when the Jewish people had largely turned away from idols. So it gives us more behind the scenes picture that because God was angry, he allowed Satan to do this. But Satan's revealed gradually for these very reasons. Otherwise, there'd be even more worship of him. You tell me. Okay, one more. All right, sorry, I'm trying to balance out male, female. Yes, go ahead. Yeah. Okay, so sometimes you get discouraged because you don't know Hebrew. Can I tell you how to get really discouraged? No. It'll the real discouragement will encourage you. I'm serious. So if you're discouraged because you don't know Hebrew, start trying to learn Hebrew. Then you get really discouraged, and then you feel good that you don't know it and just read the English. Okay. So to read it through a Hebrew lens, I mean, remember we're reading the whole Bible, right? And, you know, when Paul wrote to the Corinthians, was he writing through a Hebrew lens? You know, to what extent? You know, there's a lot more culture to take in, a lot more background. And even to say this is Hebraic thinking versus Greek thinking, sometimes this can be overstated. But one good practice always is to look at multiple translations. So if I was just doing this on the most basic level, aside from looking at Messianic translations of the Bible, like Tree of Life or a complete Jewish Bible, I'd also look at Jewish translations by those who don't believe in Yeshua. So, for example, the New JPS translation, which came out in 1985, that's the best translation by Jewish scholars of the Hebrew Bible into English. You'll see a lot of words translated differently. And now there's a debate, which is like Genesis 15:6, that Abram believed Lord and it was counted to him as righteousness. You find a Jewish translation that say it was counted to his merit. Okay, well, which is right? Now you dig in a little bit. Okay, why the difference? What's the difference in understanding? Or if you want to get an Orthodox Jewish perspective, the Stone translation. Stone translation. So you read the translations, you say, okay, this is how the rabbis looked at this. This is, you know, why the differences. The other thing is to just get yourself a cultural background Bible. And that'll give you ancient Near Eastern perspective, Greco-Roman perspective. So a cultural background Bible, Zondervan has one just in one volume, Old Testament by John Walt, New Testament by my friend Craig Keener. So that'll just give you tons of relevant background, Jewish, ancient Near Eastern, Greco-Roman. Those are helpful. There's something I'm working on that's it's a ways down the line, so I can't talk about it yet, but that will be helpful in that regard too. I'll tell you what, just one more real quick one, okay? All the way in the back. Yes, go ahead. Oh, wait, hang on. I thought we had to exit the building at a certain point. Oh, okay.
Okay, well.
Hang on. Oh, we got plenty of time. What are we? I'm good. I was misled by us. Yeah. Yes.
You know, his name was being caused pain and mother gave him the name.
Okay.
And I didn't understand how, you know, say the names don't have a meaning.
No, the names do have a meaning. I'm sorry if that was confusing. For example, the name Jacob, Yaakov, it most likely comes from a longer sentence saying that God or Yahweh will protect. All right. But when he's given the name Jacob, he's given the name Jacob because he's grabbing the akev, the ankle of his brother Esau. So even though the name had probably a more positive meaning, he's given a name ankle grabber, okay, Yaakov. And then Esau says, you're just like your name, because Yaakov, with a different root, can also mean deceiver. So you're a deceiver. So let's say that my parents named me Michael, because Michael in Hebrew is Mikhael, who is like God. And they said, let's worship God and say, who is like God? He gave us a son named Michael. Now, later on, you say, well, they call him Mike because he preaches from the mic. It's a play on words. But the names had meaning for sure. Most of the biblical names have clear meaning for the children. Then the question is it just a nice name you liked? Or did you name it because of the meaning? Or did the meaning tie in with something, was it given because of that significance, or was it given just because you happen to like the name? Like you may come up with a name, let's name our kid this, and then you look up what it means. Like here, you know, for example, in I think one of Muhammad's wives was named Bilqis. So when I was studying Arabic in grad school, American Muslim, American guy converted to Islam, came up to me and said, hey, we're thinking of naming our daughter Bilqis, but I don't know what the word means, what it comes from. I was just curious. So I looked at it, I thought, okay, that's four letters. That's not normal. If it does have have three letters in the root, and why four? And I thought, okay, wait, does that go back to Hebrew at Pelegesh and concubine, which is what it goes back to? It's like, yeah, you just named your daughter concubine. But for him, it was the wife of, you know, he knew it through Arabic a different way. So the fact that it originally meant something was not an issue to him. Yeah. But it did take a while before I told him. All right, sir, go ahead.
I was just curious. Scroll oldest form of Hebrew.
Yeah. So is there something that goes back to curses at Mount Ebal? It really could be. I mean, it's very interesting.
I was just curious because they found the divine name on the three letters, the center letter, the H, was in a figure of a man.
Yeah, so I when I looked at it and the descriptions about it, somehow I didn't notice that part. So I'm sorry. I'll check later, just out of curiosity, but I can't comment on that just because I haven't looked at it.
I even Pan and Dr. Pan. Yeah. Had structure as a bigger picture. God,
yeah. Yeah. So here's what's really interesting. There was a Russian mathematician, Ivan Panin, who became a believer and found extraordinary mathematical repetitions, sequences in the Greek New Testament. So I use that to battle people with the Bible codes. Like, you get your proof, I got my proof. It's brilliant. It's, other scholars have tested it. And it's just, it would speak of divine inspiration. In other words, sequences of sevens or sequences, other numerical sequences that you couldn't plan that are just found in the text. The problem, again, is which Greek text are you using? There are 300,000 potential variants. So that's where it breaks down. You know, you have to agree on one text, and every letter of that has to be perfectly authoritative. But it's fascinating. It's definitely fascinating. Yes. Yeah.
I was going to say, well, can you argue that I just think there's a divine pattern in everything because we're living in the God
right
of the world. So, like, Babylon, for instance, Babylon chief's like sequence is seen in plants and flowers and everything because everything's so meticulous because God created everything. So, I personally don't see a problem with finding patterns in sequences as long as it's drawing me closer to the essence of Christ.
Right. So, since God made the universe, it's not a surprise that we can see all kinds of mathematical equations and sequences in nature and other things. So that being the case, then that would not point to unique inspiration of Scripture necessarily. It would just point to God's hand in everything. My issue is not sequences. My issue is finding secret meanings, right? So if there are numerical sequences that repeat, and how do you explain that? Fascinating. That I'm all for signs of divine inspiration. Bring it on. But it's when you find secret meanings, and when a lot of it is whatever you manufacture, that's what concerns me. I mean, we'll take one or two more. Hang on. You know the principle of Oswald Smith, Pastor Oswald Smith. Why should anyone hear the gospel twice when people haven't heard it once? So the double dippers here. We've got other people with questions. Yes, go ahead. Well, Adam can be the proper name, Adam, or man, or humankind. Adama is dust, earth, but his name remains the same. Yeah, he's taken from the dust, the earth, hence Adam, taken from Adama. But the name actually means man, mankind, or just the guy Adam. Yeah. All right, one last question. All right, well, two last ones, front and back. Okay, yes, sir. You can go ahead.
The question I have for you is, of all the Bibles that have been translated into English since the King James Version.
Yeah.
And I'm alluding to references like the NLT, NIV.
Yeah.
You made a reference that was talking about primary source. You said, something about this is the primary Bible, primary source. I'm kind of lost. I know what I'm asking. I hope you know what I'm asking.
Okay.
what I'm saying is that when I read certain scriptures in the King James Version, that's the Aramaic.
Right.
King James.
Right.
And I may take the time to look at the other versions.
Right.
And I look at a particular scripture and I look at the Bible for Bible.
Right.
The translations between them are so different.
Right. So the King. Yeah, the King James translators in their day used the Hebrew and Greek, same that we have today, except we just have more manuscripts, more evidence. They used the same Hebrew and Greek that we have today and did their best to translate it into the English of the day. If they were alive today, based on the preface, what they wrote, they would be translating something in contemporary English. So they went to the primary sources, those are the originals, the Hebrew and the Greek. The English is a translation from that. So the NIV translators or the ESV translators or the NASB, they all did the same thing the King James translators did. They went back to the original and they translated it into the language of the day as best as possible. A good method is to compare four or five different translations, King James, New King James, a few other English, NIV, ESV, NASB. Compare them. If they're all saying the same thing, then you know, okay, there's no ambiguity in the Hebrew or the Greek. If the King James is the only one saying it and the others saying it differently, you can be assured that we have more evidence now for the more accurate reading, right? I know that when you get used to something, that's like the Bible. And, you know, I remember the first time that someone pointed out a different way to translate something from than the King James had. I was floored. Because when I used to memorize 20 verses a day, I memorized them out of King James, and to every letter, you know, just, I mean, every, if it was italicized, I mean, I knew it. But that was still just English. Okay, last question. This better be worthy. The last question is. Wait, off topic. There is no topic. There is no topic. Yeah. Got it. So that really was off topic. No, good topic. So based on lots of books I've written in recent years and what's happening in the world, what are the key things I would say? The first is keep the main thing the main thing. For me, in the Lord, almost 51 years now, I'm continually back to the basics, back to the basics, back to the basics, back to the basics. Make the main thing the main thing. Why are we here? For example, we're going to get really caught up in the next few years with election fever, okay? Elections are very important, but they're secondary. They're secondary to the Great Commission. They're secondary to the God's people living holy, godly lives. They're important, but they're secondary. So keep the main thing the main thing. Why are we here? We're here to know God and to make God known. Why are we here? We're here to be disciples and to make disciples. So same thing. You're in seminary. Right, it's so easy to get caught up with 100 other topics. This is fascinating, but you end up, you know, you're called to do evangelism, but you never get to it because you're so fascinated with other subjects. So keep the main thing the main thing, because the distractions are going to increase. And develop some spiritual backbone, because the attacks will get greater. The opposition will get greater. The attempts to silence us. My book, Silencing of the Lambs, is very intense reading, even though the second half of the book is full of strategies and encouragement and faith-building things. One of my friends said he couldn't read it at night because the first half, because it was too devastating. He didn't want to read that before he fell asleep. But that's the world we live in. So keep the main thing the main thing. Be involved in other causes, but don't be distracted. I shared this in a class Thursday, that Charles Finney in the 1830s had a warning for one of his converts, Theodore Weld. Theodore Weld came to faith and was so terribly burdened about the evils of slavery that became his primary cause. Finney was also an abolitionist. If you were part of Finney's church in New York City and had anything to do with slave trade, he wouldn't give you communion. When he was president of Oberlin College, that became an escape route for slaves. So Finney was a strong abolitionist. But he said, unless we make abolition an appendage, to revival. So church coming alive, Great Commission, and then fight for what's right. So do it. Absolutely do it. But tie it in with the larger mission of the church. He said, we're going to have a bloody civil war. Basically prophesied it. We're going to have a wave of blood across the nation. So the same thing, you know, we're strongly pro-life, right? We want to see racial justice. We want to see God work in a bunch of ways. These are all important, but when that becomes the main cause and we're no longer first and foremost Great Commission people, then we just end up with political battles and division. When we have the first thing, and then everything else follows, we should be having an impact in the society around us. Everything else should follow, but it's going to get really, really wild. My most recent book is called The Political Seduction of the Church, because it's just so easy to marry the gospel and politics, or to become an appendage to a political party. So we're God's people, the ecclesia, we're called to something better and higher. So we live this out, keep the main thing, don't get distracted, and develop some spiritual backbone. That's what I'd say. And with that, my apologies, we are done.